everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see below the surface.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And this is episode number 71. Mm-mm. And we're going to talk about The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson.
It's spooky.
Heck yeah. Yeah, it's a literary, what'd you call it? Literary ghost story is what I'm going to call it.
I guess that's right, because she was such a wonderful writer.
Yeah, she was, from the very first paragraph.
Oh. And that paragraph is such a classic. Whenever people talk about paragraphs that begin books or starting lines, this one always comes to mind for me.
Yeah, yeah, and this is the first time I've read it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so when I read that, I was like, wow, what am I in for here? I mean, yeah. It was really something, really something.
Shall I read it?
Yeah, please do.
No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not seen, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within, walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. You just go, oh my gosh.
Yep, you had me at hello, right?
I know. And I have read this book so many times since I was, oh gosh, probably a teenager, because my mother loved Shirley Jackson. So she would have her collections of short stories and books around the house. And this one had so many things that I admired again reading it through this time. The way she could just change a mood instantly to where it's light and laughing and funny, and then you see somebody's thoughts, well, I guess Eleanor's thoughts, and suddenly you're plunged into a completely different mood. Mm-hmm. And when I was reading this, toward the end especially, I started thinking of my other favorite haunted house book, which is The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
And I've never thought to compare these two. I don't know why. And I love The Shining. But Stephen King wishes he could write it like this. The Shining seemed like, you know, a fun house at the carnival compared to this. A lot more crudely drawn. And like I say, I love it. You know, but this is a much more subtle masterpiece, despite the fact that it's super terrifying to me.
For sure. Yeah. And I would point at Salem's Lot, too. You know, in Salem's Lot, the house was a major part of the Marston house.
Well, you're right. I forgot that.
So, I mean, it had a lot of the same qualities as this house, because everybody in town knew there was something wrong with it. And, you know, it was up there. Well, on this one, the house isn't like up on a hill where everybody can see it all the time. It's behind a bend and everything. You have to kind of drive there.
It's huddled down into the hills. Yeah. And I loved the reaction everybody had driving up was, oh my gosh, it was like a very evil face. Mm-hmm. She even describes it as a face. You know, this house looks down all arrogant and evil and uncaring.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, whoa, I almost had a car wreck.
And the angles aren't quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt, that was what I thought of as far as Stephen King goes, because I know Stephen King likes this book, and I was going to read some, but I didn't get it done. He wrote a book called, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Danse Macabre, I guess?
Oh, Danse Macabre.
Yeah.
That's it. Which is a great book.
Yeah. I've read that book a long time ago, but I know that he talked about this book in there.
I need to reread that book. It's a nonfiction book that he wrote just pretty much about the history of horror, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in literature.
Right.
And it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
That was when I realized, oh, he can write nonfiction very, very well. I read it when it came out, but I haven't read it since then.
Yeah, but I know that he mentioned this, and I think that was the first place I even heard of this book.
Okay.
You know, the influence of it on.
You didn't grow up reading it over and over.
I
I'm
didn't.
sorry, Scott.
And what else of Shirley Jackson's is
Oh, my
good?
favorite book that she wrote that I almost chose, but this one is better known, The Haunting of Hill House is better known, is We Have Always Lived in the Castle.
We Have Always Lived in the Castle. All
And
right.
that's about two spinster sisters who their whole family died under mysterious circumstances some time ago. And so they've been shunned by the townspeople. And again, it's a small town full of a bunch of, you know, crude hillbilly types, very similar to this town that Hill House is near.
Oh, cool.
And it's told from the point of view of the youngest sister.
Okay.
And the house isn't haunted, but it's just an amazing story. And we will read it sometime. I don't know how she does it. And then she wrote a couple of very funny books that are completely normal and hilarious about raising a family called Raising Savages and Life Among the Demons. And they're really wonderful. I love them. And then she also wrote tons of short stories, most famously The Lottery.
Okay.
Which most school kids, I guess, have to read. But in my day, they weren't, because she was still, I think, writing or just recently dead. And
okay.
They weren't teaching that kind of thing in school. And you've read that, right?
The Lottery? I don't recall having read it.
What?
Yeah, what? Maybe I have.
I have a reading of it where the sound quality is not very good.
Okay.
Which would make somebody like Jesse, who doesn't like my sound quality now, just kind of cry. But I have a link to it on my last post at Forgotten Classics if you want to just hear
okay.
it.
I'll do that, yeah. And you
I'm
know,
sure
it
I
may
should.
Be that I've read it and just not remembering.
Yeah, I'm sure I shouldn't have read it because it's in copyright, but it was just a sample of her horror writing. That's under the Fair Use Act. Yeah, that's
cool.
That's
it. So it's horror, too. So
mm-hmm.
She was writing... I mean, that was her normal thing, was horror.
Yeah, and the thing is what she was really good at, and you see that in this book, is she was good at taking things that seemed everyday and then suddenly twisting them around. And there was always kind of this sense of something wrong under the surface, but you didn't know what. And kind of the way, you know, when Eleanor leaves to go to the haunted house...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, she's going, and she's not really quite sure even what's going on, but it's like a vacation.
Yeah.
You know, she's, oh, maybe I won't come back. Maybe I'll stay in this little town. Oh, I could have lived here. And I really loved that part because she's doing what we all do when we're going on vacation. You've been cut loose from everything normal, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe you don't do that.
No, of course I do.
But, you know, you go through little towns, you go, I could live here. I, you know,
heck yeah.
I could never go home again. This is wonderful. Not for the same reasons. My family isn't awful like hers and selfish.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
But you can see that she's been put upon her whole life. She, I guess to tell the story, since we kind of jumped ahead, is these four people. Well, one of them is a doctor who's wants to write a book about psychic phenomena. And he has recruited a couple of people to come and join him based on things that occurred to them in their past. And then there's another person who's foisted on him by the family that owns Hill House, which has quite a reputation for being haunted. But nobody will say exactly what happened. They just all earnestly say, don't ever go near that house. Stay away. Don't set foot in it. It's terrible.
Don't do it.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I can't tell you what happened, but it was terrible. And so he sends out a dozen letters. The two people who respond are Eleanor, who frankly is in a terrible situation. She was a companion to her ailing mother for 12 years. And then her mother died. And so now she's got nothing. It doesn't seem like she's trained for any kind of a job, and she's living with her sister and brother-in-law in a spare room, and they're horrible people, very selfish and self-absorbed, and so she's eager to get away and do something different. And then Theodora, who had a fight with her roommate, is like, okay, fine, I'll do it. I'm up for anything. And she's kind of a lively, I don't know, free spirit. And so the four of them gather in this house, and they're going to stay there for a while and record what happens. And then I guess the other people are the Dudleys. the caretaker and his wife who does the housekeeping and cooking, and they're the how do you describe the Dudleys?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. They
there's nothing lovable about them.
Not at all. It's like, oh, you're going to have a terrible time here. This is going to be the worst experience you've ever had. Can I show you to your room?
Well, and they don't even reach out that much. Mrs. Dudley is just saying, I set breakfast on the table at 9. I clear off at 10. I whatever. And if they try to engage her in conversation, she just looks at them. And then she goes back to whatever it is that she's saying.
That was a funny scene. You know, when she's like, I clear at 10. And it's 10. And they're all trying to decide whether to go down for breakfast or not. And finally he said, all right, just clear it.
Yeah, but they're having some more coffee. And she just looks at them and she's like, the dishes go back on the sideboard. Mm-hmm. And Dudley, you only see Dudley once, but he doesn't want to let anyone in. But it's not because he cares about them. It's because he's just so awfully awful.
Yeah. Neither of them are willing to be at the house after sundown.
Right.
Which should be a clue that you shouldn't go in there.
Yeah, I'll be home, and I don't have a phone, or there's no phone here, and I can't hear you if you scream in the dark. Mrs. Dudley always ends the introduction. No, why did you say that?
Yeah.
And when they're exploring the house, they go in the kitchen, and the kitchen is just full of doors. They're just like, well, she could certainly get away in any direction she wants to fast.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And on this, one thing that surprised me about it is that she introduces these four characters kind of in equal space. Mm-hmm. And then, so I expected, okay, we're going to get to know all four of these people. And what really happens from there is the focus goes on Eleanor for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, you know, almost her point of view. Not quite. You know,
right.
When we hear people's thoughts, inner thoughts, it's her we're listening to.
Yeah. We only get her interpretation of everything.
Mm-hmm. And so that surprised me, you know, from the opening. I was expecting some kind of a trading off of all four of these people, you know.
Well, and I have to say, I've never questioned this before, but at some point in the book, things have started happening, but they're not too terrifying or not, I guess, yet. And so Luke and Theodora, in their way, are being amusing and all that kind of thing. And the doctor and Eleanor are having a conversation where they're saying, well, that's how they're coping. It's their way of whistling in the dark, you know, and being brave. And so then the doctor says, well, our only line of defense is running away. But none of them run away. They could leave any time.
Yeah.
They all stay. And I keep thinking, I know why Eleanor stays. She's got nowhere else to go, essentially, that she wants to be. Why the doctor stays, he's doing his book. But Luke and Theodora, I guess they're just there, and so it's kind of like everybody's on a desert island in a way.
Yeah, kind of like that.
And they do say that at one point. They say, well, I know Mrs. Dudley and Dudley must leave because she comes back with peaches and cream and stuff like that every day, but is there an outside world? And they've only been there for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, and my impression when I think about that was that Eleanor was tied into the house, right?
Yeah.
And the other three were observing it and enjoying it.
I don't know how much they were enjoying it, but... Yeah,
that's just the, you know, it was almost like they all three had this inside thing, you know, and maybe I need to read it again, but they like when they were talking to Eleanor and Eleanor was freaking out and they were tell her, you know, to stop freaking out, you know, and everything's okay. Yeah. But it was almost as if those three shared this knowledge that they were watching this person and they thought it was enjoyable.
Oh, see, I didn't feel that way. I felt that they weren't taking Eleanor seriously.
Oh.
I just felt that they thought she was the twitchiest one.
Uh-huh.
They had to keep an eye on her because, you know, every so often she'd say things. And that's where I was also thinking, she's talking about it would be easier if she surrendered, and she feels like she's almost dissolving into the house with one half of her brain, and you're not sending her away, doctor. What the heck? You're a jerk. Which I never got that feeling before, but the thing, so what happens is that eventually things start to happen. I mean, it's from the very first, the house is creepy. It's built on a weird design. The guy who built it was, something was off, because he deliberately built it with every angle a little askew, so they can't leave any doors open. And very early on, you find, well, meaning that the doors all just kind of slam shut, no matter what. But very early on, you get the feeling that the house is being fairly active in this, because they're sitting at breakfast, the doctor and Luke, and Eleanor and Theodora can't find their way to breakfast the first morning that they're there. And they said, you know how we knew you were coming? We watched all the doors slam shut. And so the doctor's saying, maybe it's vibrations from you walking and the house is not, you know, on plumb and all that kind of thing. And they're saying, well, but this door should go here. Nope, but I've studied a map. So it's like they're lost in a maze also. And the house kind of takes delight in misleading them. And then in this reading, the way I felt, and especially after I talked to Hannah last night about something that we could talk about in a little while, that I felt was the only weak point in the plot. But what I realized this time is the house is getting inside their heads. It's not that the house is necessarily doing everything that the house is doing. It's working on their brains, I think. Because at one point, that's the only explanation I could come up with for some of this stuff. And it's not like you have to explain it, but before I always took it as genuine haunted house stuff. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. The very first thing that happens, really big thing that happens, is Theodora and Eleanor are in the room and there's something pounding on the door with, like, you know, impossibly high, trying to get in all the doors. They're like, it's pounding on the door with a cannonball. And there's waves of icy cold coming at them. And then it's stopping and it's padding around the door trying to get in. Oh, it was so creepy. But then later, the doctor and Luke come back. They'd been chasing a little animal that they, or something like that, that they saw that led them outside. They never heard one noise.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they would,
and they started to feel that, okay, that we were separated on purpose for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And
they would continually be separated, and things would happen to both sets, but that the other set should have been aware of, could have been aware of, and wasn't.
Yeah, and there was also the second time that that happened,
the pounding?
Yeah, the pounding. It said something about silent pounding, didn't it?
Oh, I don't remember that.
I mean, I don't have that marked right here, but it was, you know, I read that paragraph a couple times and I was like, so is the door shaking and there's no sound?
Well, because that's when they're all four together, because the doctor's wife has shown up.
Oh, man. She's a hoot.
Wasn't she hilarious? I mean, not on purpose. Well, Shirley Jackson wrote her that way on purpose. But she's like the worst woman ever. Very domineering. She's insistent on doing planchette, which is this automatic writing that, you know, to get in touch with the spirits. And she'll come back and go, was there a nun here? I got a message from a nun. And the doctor's just clutching his head going, no, there's real evil here. You're going to kill us all with this perfect love concept. And then she has an assistant who's this bluff, hearty schoolmaster type guy, Arthur. And see, that was the other thing where I suddenly went, oh, if the house is in their heads, Arthur and Mrs. Montague didn't hear a thing.
Yeah,
and the whole house was being pounded on like crazy.
Yeah, and that's hilarious because they're the ones that think that they're in tune with everything. I mean, that was funny stuff.
Right. And in fact, did she not feel the cold spot where the two cherubs' gazes met? Or
I don't remember her feeling.
I don't remember.
I don't remember her feeling anything at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, she thought she was. She knew what was going on. That's funny.
But that also kind of explained to me the idea that Theodore's clothes were all marked with that blood that smelled so horrible, and then later they unlocked the door and everything's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. So it's not in their heads, though. I mean, it's the house kind of interacting with their heads. So it's real to them. Because I got, you know,
I think it's real.
You know,
I just don't know how it's real.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've heard it compared, and I think you said too that, you know, it's like it's better than Turn of the Screw.
Yeah.
And Turn of the Screw is by Henry James, and that's one that we read. And that one, when it ends, you've got a real feeling of ambiguity. Like, you could read it in a way where, you know, somebody was just crazy or they were being influenced or something like that. And I didn't get the impression that this was ambiguous. I thought that Eleanor was definitely being influenced, and probably, you know, from the moment she walked in the house.
Yeah.
There was little clues and things that in the way that she thought and everything that said to me that she was being worked on by that house.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, the thing is she's the narrator, essentially. I mean, there is a third-person narrator who you can more or less trust because it's just kind of reporting, you know, here's what the house looked like or that kind of thing. But she's our unreliable narrator. I mean, everything that we know of what she's thinking is what she's telling us that she's thinking. So you don't know if, did she write that stuff on the wall? I don't think she did.
Right.
When it says, help Eleanor come home. But there is the possibility you could read it in the way that she was kind of disturbed to start with. And so she was manipulating a lot of things unknowingly, almost crazy.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I believe that Eleanor was, you know, she starts off talking about the poor little kids who had to grow up there. And then later she just relates to the little companion who inherited the house. And is that the one who hung herself in the turret? I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I bought into the whole thing.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, enough that it did. I didn't question it.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like Eleanor was a susceptible mind, and that's kind of why she was invited. And, you know, again, I felt like that the professor, Montague, he was enjoying watching this happen because it was, you know, this was like validation for him. I mean, he was like, here I am, you know, I'm doing science now.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's how I felt about it. And, you know, and I felt like these three were kind of watching her slowly lose it. That's the strong impression that I got.
You've
read it more times than me, so.
Oh, but that doesn't even, it's each person's experience with the book is completely valid, because I think that's part of the ambiguity that's written in. You don't know. You got that feeling, which I've never gotten, but it wasn't until this time, because I was reading it to talk about it, so I was thinking about it much more than I usually would, that I thought about the fact that, wait a minute, this is happening inside their heads. It's working on all of them. We just don't see it as much because the others are stronger personalities. And so therefore, I never really noticed. I kind of was always aware because they would kind of talk lightly, at least Theo and Luke, about how selfish they were. And it was a little bit of a joke. But this time, I actually was in mass, and I guess because you're supposed to be thinking about nicer things there, you know, and how you're all to help each other and blah, 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 which I guess I shouldn't say it that way. But, you know, it's true. But the contrast suddenly with these people who are all completely, if not actively selfish, self-absorbed, is really a great contrast. And Eleanor is the only one who, she's trying to reach out. She's trying to connect because she never had a friend. She never got to do a lot of the normal things because she was sucked into helping her mother, which, you know, that's legit, but she had no one to love her. And so while she's looking for this, and she's kind of that needy, kind of a bit of a weirdo, that everybody's kind of like, oh, you seem great. Oh, wait, you're not, something's weird about you. And so I saw it as Luke and Theodora kind of going, oh, well, this is just this little situation that we're in. We don't have to ever talk to you again. So this is fine. And the doctor just being absorbed with his book and not paying attention enough, going, and I didn't feel like they were watching her deliberately going, ooh, look at her freak out. I just felt like they were all so self-absorbed, they didn't even stop to think about it. And the one person who should have was the doctor. But even if he noticed stuff, and there were plenty of times when he did and just ignored it, either the house was in his head making him ignore it, or he was just going, ooh, I have to write this down, and not taking enough care.
Yeah, that's how I felt he was. Ooh, I got to write this down, is the type of guy that I thought that he was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I agree with you 100%. You know, they're all, you know, not excellent people.
Although they do some very amusing conversations. There are things when they're talking and you're just laughing.
Yeah, for sure.
And really liking them.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. It'd be fun to hang out with for an evening, for sure.
Oh, yeah. But Luke is a petty thief. You know, his aunt sends him there because she doesn't know what else to do with him, because he's always doing things like seducing her bridge partners or the people that she knows and then taking their silver. You know, he's a cad and a bounder, basically, a charming one.
Yeah.
And Theodora, you get the idea that she's very selfish and self-absorbed, and she just likes her own little life, and she doesn't put herself out for other people.
No, not at all. There was a quote, duty and conscience were for Theodora attributes which belonged properly to Girl Scouts.
Oh, yeah.
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 So, yeah, you're exactly right.
But they do have a lot of terrifying things that happen. I don't mean to make it sound like it's psychological.
No, not at all. One more thing before we get there.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to decide if there was significance to what Montague was reading. He was reading a book called Pamela by Samuel Richardson, something that I'd never heard of.
Oh, I'd heard of it, but I've never read it.
Yeah, so I just looked it up on Wikipedia. It says it's a novel set in 1740. So this professor was reading this book at night. He'd read it when he went to bed. It says, it tells a story of a beautiful 15-year-old maidservant named Pamela Andrews, whose nobleman master, Mr. B, makes unwanted advances toward her after the death of his mother, whose maid she was since the age 12. Mr. B is infatuated with her, first by her looks and then her innocence and intelligence, but his high rank hinders him from proposing marriage. He abducts her, locks her up in one of his estates, and attempts to seduce and rape her. She rejects him continually, but starts to realize that she is falling in love with him. He intercepts her letters to her parents. Reading them, he becomes more enamored by her innocence, intelligence, and continuous escape attempts. Her virtue is eventually rewarded when he sincerely proposes an equitable marriage to her. And then it says in the novel's second part, she attempts to build a successful relationship with him and to acclimatize to upper-class society. So, anyway, that was interesting, but I didn't quite connect, you know, is there a significance to that? And I'm guessing that there is, but I haven't quite put my finger on it.
Well, if that young, innocent girl who has no experience of the world is shut up with continually being assaulted by an outside force to try to get her to submit, that
then
could
she's
be
like
Eleanor in the house.
Yeah, Eleanor in the house. You know? It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
Which would put him, you know, it would make it like, you know, he knew what he was doing the whole time. And he was like, I'm going to put her in here and she's going to go nuts. But he was the one who sent her out of there, too. He said, you need to leave.
I guess.
And he did say at one time, hey, if this gets bad, you're going to have to leave.
Yeah. And that was the part that Hannah and I were talking about.
Okay.
Because I never noticed until this reading that at the end, when they're making her leave, because she's been and we've seen several scenes internally where she's, okay, I give in.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm happy. And now the cold spot isn't even there. I can go in the library, which I couldn't go into before because it had a horrible smell that no one noticed. All these things.
Yeah.
And she, under the possession of the house, essentially almost gets out to the turret. And they have to rescue her. It's very dangerous. And that's when they're like, okay, this has gone too far. You have to leave. And so it's the next morning. And the doctor is saying, goodbye, none of us will write to you because you need to be as far away from Hill House and separated from every one of us as you can be. And Mrs. Montague, for the first time, is sounding like a normal person. She's like, I really think Arthur should drive her, make sure she gets home okay. And he's like, nope, she has to leave the way she came. And that point was when I was going, wait a minute. You're the one who, toward the beginning, said people who try to leave when the house has kind of got its hooks into you are the ones who die. You gave us the example of the guy whose horse bolted and crushed him into a big tree.
Yeah.
You said, I can't let you leave after dark because I don't know what would happen, and all these various things. And I'm like, and now you're insisting she goes by herself? Because she tries twice to go, I really think, no, no. And I'm just like, what? And to me, that was a big plot flaw.
Uh-huh.
But when I talked to Hannah, Hannah said she just thought it was evidence of how the house was influencing him and he didn't realize it.
For sure.
Because it's,
yeah,
again,
it's either that or he's doing it on purpose, right? He's like, I've got to see what happens here, you know, which is a horrible way to read that
guy.
Which
is even worse.
Yeah, but it's like,
I don't think he would have done that.
I don't think.
Or he wouldn't have sent her away.
Yeah.
You know?
But he was like testing a theory that he had.
Yeah. Oh, boy, you really had a terrible view of him.
I really did. Yeah.
Well, you might be right. I just never thought of him that way. Mm-hmm. I just thought of him as more clueless and willing to kind of ignore stuff. But wow, that would be even worse.
It was almost like he was a cold, detached, just observer.
Yeah.
The house's influence everybody makes really a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Interesting.
Because he never got to write his, well, I guess he did write his book because he wrote a preliminary article, it says, at the beginning, and he got cool, almost contemptuous reception.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But I really kind of thought of it more as, once Hannah said that, I was like, oh, because the other thing I thought was interesting was, and this we wound up talking about, was I never really paid much attention to the part where Eleanor is at some point, close to when she just gives in and loses it, is spying on everybody. She's sneaking around listening to see what they say about her.
Yeah.
And this is very much in the pattern of the story that we're told about the little companion who was very paranoid and thought people were creeping around and behind her back and all that kind of thing.
I told you earlier that I read a lot of this thinking that Eleanor was a teenager. I couldn't help thinking that she was a teenager the whole time, but she's not.
Mm-mm.
She's, you know, she spent a lot of time taking care of her mom and things. It's just like you said, she's stunted in some way.
Yeah, she's emotionally stunted. She never got to have the experiences anyone else had because she was essentially ignored. Her mother was old and crotchety and sick,
mm-hmm.
and sounds like very demanding and uncaring. And you get a very vivid view of the brother or the sister and brother-in-law in the beginning when all she wants to do is drive the car out to Hill House and spend a week or two there, and they're finding all these reasons why she shouldn't. And she's like, it's half my car. It's half my car. And as they talk, they're gradually coming over to, and our car. And why should you take our car? It's half mine, mm-hmm. she keeps saying.
Yeah.
So she's just not treated nicely by anyone. I mean, the nicest person that she meets in the entire book is, well, other than the little girl with her cup full of stars.
Yeah,
is,
that was a nice quote, too.
I know. Is the little lady who she inadvertently knocks over.
Hmm.
He drops the food that she'd taken from some party.
Oh, okay.
And Eleanor pays for a taxi.
Oh, yeah, I remember
go
that.
Home, and she's all pray for
that,
you.
Yeah.
And so no one is ever nice to her.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting.
You know, poor Eleanor.
I'd forgotten about that moment. I wonder what the significance of that was. Just showing, I mean, Eleanor's character, I guess.
Although the lady says, well, I'll pray for you. And she says, well, that's something. I have someone praying for me, I think is what she says. And then later, toward the end, after she's just completely going nuts, she does say, someone's praying for me.
Oh, wow. Okay. I missed it.
It's just a little moment of connection back with that beginning outside world where she's suddenly thinking, wait, someone cared.
Yeah.
You know, because she wants to go live with Theo or be around Theo. And Theo's like, oh, no.
I don't take in stray cats or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah,
And because
didn't it
she's
end up that
begging.
Theodora doesn't even have a place of her own anyway?
No, that's Eleanor.
No, I thought Theodora, I mean, we found out that she's not.
Oh, no, she does.
Okay. Okay,
She had
good.
a fight with her roommate.
Okay.
And that's why she left, and she's got a place to go to.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
But she was saying, you know, I won't take in strays and
yeah.
yeah. So it
Exactly.
wasn't like an equal relationship anyway, you know. So Eleanor, to everybody, was a kid, it seemed like, you know, and they treated her that way too.
Well, and it kind of starts off that way because when she and Theodora meet each other and they go walking down to the creek and they have the first little suspicion that there's something out there in the bushes and they don't know what it is, and they say it's a rabbit, or Theodora says it's a rabbit, but Eleanor's like, I didn't see anything and I was looking too. So Theodora made that up, but they're talking as if it's like girls' camp or Girl Scout camp or something like that. So that kind of sets the tone for these are really kind of all a bunch of adolescents now that I think about it in that way. There's no grown-up adult type person there caring. And the funny thing is as awful as Mrs. Montague is, I really was so surprised also. I didn't remember the part where she's like, well, I really will speak to Mrs. Dudley. This is wonderful. I will speak to her. And then the next day, when Eleanor's sneaking around listening to everyone, she's been in the kitchen helping Mrs. Dudley get lunch ready or dinner. And she's, oh, well, do you want some help now with this? What should we do now? And Mrs. Dudley's like, oh, you've done plenty. Sit down, take the weight off your feet, and have a cup of coffee. And they're just chatting very normally. And that's when I suddenly started going, how much of what I've seen of these people is actually accurate? I mean, Mrs. Dudley's awful. But the fact that Mrs. Montague actually is helping her in the kitchen, that they're just able to chat together, those two very different kinds of personalities, was when I was like, wait a minute. And then when Mrs. Montague later is going, well, this and this and this, so we really shouldn't let her away. Let's let Arthur drive her. And that was the most caring anybody was. And yeah, she's a loon and she's overbearing, but I suddenly felt a very warm feeling toward her.
That's really
She had
interesting, yeah.
more dimensions than I expected, and I suddenly went, I wonder if that view of her as, the horrible person was pushed,
Yeah.
really accentuated somehow.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, it's from a different point of view or something. So,
Yeah,
from
because,
Eleanor's point of view, she sees her, yeah, like
yeah,
it's
and
how
the,
Eleanor sees her.
well, or what she overhears is not what the group sees.
Right.
It's because she's just sneaking around looking at stuff. And the thing that was so sad to me was she's sneaking around wanting to see what they say about her because she's sure they're talking and saying bad things about her. And what she finds is no one's even thinking about her. No one even mentions her. And Luke and Theo actually, they're in the gazebo kind of just flirting and hanging out. And they talk at one point about, I think it's about what Dr. Montague will put in his book. And they talk about everybody. They even mention Dudley. He'll be like this, and this will be like that. They never mention Eleanor once. And that's when I started going, she doesn't even matter that much. They don't even mention her. Has she already kind of been absorbed into the house? And what Hannah was thinking is she said she thought that's how much the house was influencing everyone without them realizing it because it wanted to always separate them. And it separates them by not even making them think about Eleanor. I felt it just meant that Eleanor was such a cipher, nobody even called her to mind as a person. And that was really even sadder.
Interesting.
But this book has just got layers and layers. Well, on the surface, I don't want to make people think this is just some psychological book. It's creepy.
It is creepy.
Did you have a scary moment that was the worst of all?
Oh, let's see. Probably holding hands in the dark and then
Right.
realizing
Oh.
that the person's across the room. That stuff is
That,
like, holy crap, whose hand am I holding?
for me too. And that's what Hannah said. She goes, oh, the worst part was the holding hands in the dark. The whose hand was I holding?
Because
she could feel the fine bones in Theodora's hand, and then she wakes up and it wasn't Theodora.
Oh, shoot. Heck yeah. Yeah, and sitting in a room, you know, while something's trying to get in or just slamming things around, that's pretty spooky too.
Yeah, that little, the pounding wasn't so bad as the little, what is it, little patting sounds around the door, almost little sucking sounds or something. And then that little insane laugh when you can't get in, and there's this little horrible laugh outside, and you're just like, oh, no.
There's like a Cthulhu outside or something.
Yeah, something.
But yeah, it's interesting. So this house was not haunted by a specific person. It's like the house itself was just permeated by unspeakable evil, right? I say it that way because there's this sketch that I think it's hilarious. I'll put a link to it.
What is it?
These two people are looking at houses. So they're there with a real estate agent. So it's a sketch from an English show. I forget the name of the show.
Okay.
Man Stroke Woman, I think is what it's called. And she, you know, the estate agent is just explaining things just as if everything's perfectly normal. She says, you know, so, you know, this is great. Yeah, the house is cold because it's permeated by unspeakable evil. Now, look at this window here. Isn't this a lovely window? And the wife is with the real estate agent, you know, just totally interested in the schools in the area. And the guy's like, about this evil.
I do have a question about that.
Yeah, don't go in the basement. Don't look directly at it, you know. Like
but the washer and dryer can go over.
The schools are quite lovely.
I would love to see that, yes. Yeah. Well, the thing is that about this house being evil, in The Shining, it was because so many awful things had happened in the house that it had absorbed all the evil emanations, right?
Yeah.
And so it kind of took on a life of its own, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact explanation of it, but
Oh, I think they had an explanation, Stephen King.
Yeah, I'm sure he did, yeah.
And this one, you really, from that first paragraph on, and also from the description when they drive up to the house and see what it looks like, it's not as if anything was absorbed into anything.
No, it's
like the house was built to be off center always, and it's just an evil house, and it's crouching there in that valley with all those hills hanging over it, waiting to jump out like a big spider and eat you up or something. So it's a different situation.
In fact, I remember something, you know, and I can't find it right now, but it said exorcism is not going to work on this house. I mean, it actually says that.
Yes, and I can't remember at what point, but you're right.
Yeah, so it's saying, you know, that this house is going to be that way until it burns down or whatever.
I know.
Yeah, and that was just an interesting paragraph. But yeah, I can't.
Oh, here it is. This is the beginning of chapter two where she spends quite a long paragraph, so I won't read it. But it's at one point, this is where she's saying that it has its own face and it's an evil face. And she says, almost any house caught unexpectedly or at an odd angle can turn a deeply humorous look on a watching person. Even a mischievous little chimney or a dormer like a dimple can catch up a beholder with a sense of fellowship. But a house arrogant and hating, never off guard, can only be evil. And then it talks about how this house, it rears its head against the sky without any concession to humanity. It was a house without kindness, never meant to be lived in, not a fit place for people or for love or for hope. Exorcism cannot alter the countenance of a house. Hill House would stay as it was until it was destroyed. And that's when she's driving up and she was terribly afraid, listening to the sick voice inside her, which whispered, "Get away from here, get away." And then later then she can turn it funny. It says, she's getting out of the car. It says she turned the car just enough to move off to one side out of the way of later arrivals. It would be a pity, she thought grimly, for anyone to get a first look at this house with anything so comforting as a human automobile parked in front of it.
Yeah. So that's I love it. She's such a good writer. I mean, really something.
She's the way she turns a phrase is brilliant. And the fact that this can be just straight out, it is a haunted house story. It is terrifying. And even though they keep saying, well, it never hurt us. It never hurt us. You don't get that feeling. You get the feeling that any second something awful could happen to anyone because it's just malevolent.
Right, right.
And so all those other layers that we've been talking about are the fact that those are in something that's as terrifying as this book is a real tribute to her, I think. Mm-hmm. She was so good. And I have to say, We Have Always Lived in the Castle is just as good, but in a completely different way, I think.
Well, cool. Yeah. So we're going to read that one someday?
Oh, yes, we will.
Fantastic.
Yeah, just... In fact, I really would like to start it right now. Except I've committed to too many other books to read. I don't know what happened to me. I just said yes to everything, and I should have been saying no. So...
Yeah, gotcha. Well, yeah, I just thought this was neat. You know, it's really a pleasure to have read it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I tried to get a hold of Guillermo del Toro. Last week we talked about Guillermo del Toro. And then you showed me that he did a series of books for Penguin in which he wrote introductions. And this book was one of those. And I couldn't get a hold of that, though. Did you happen to get a copy? Or
no, I didn't.
I was just interested to see what he has to say about it.
Well, I did listen to part of the audio version of this, and I was pretty excited to see it was narrated by Dominic Dunn. Is that her name?
Oh, Bernadette.
Bernadette right? Dunn. Well, yeah. Dunn is the last name.
Right.
Right, but you're right. I think it's Bernadette. And she narrated The Hiding Place.
Yeah.
And I loved her narration. And so I was very excited to hear her do this. And I was kind of disappointed. Unfortunately, I think it kind of showed up some of her flaws as a narrator.
Okay.
Because I recognize, maybe it's because I've listened to The Hiding Place twice, but I recognized the voice she was doing for Eleanor was the voice of Betsy, a sweet little innocent voice. And I finally had to quit listening because I was like, I'm sorry, Eleanor's not like Betsy. She's making her too sweet and too innocent and too, for me. You know, she was more complex than that. And then the other thing was when I never noticed this, but Shirley Jackson will do sometimes a lot of quick exchanges of dialogue where you need a real distinctive voice change so that you know who's saying what. Because sometimes what they're saying kind of echoes each other, like the sister and brother-in-law at the beginning talking about the car.
Yeah.
And it was, she doesn't change her voice quite enough or wait enough between sentences or something so that when I was listening, it was only because I knew these two people were having this conversation with Eleanor that I could tell that there were two sets of people talking. So for me, that was a problem.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting to listen to this book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You might like it better than I did. Okay. Just the way you saw that malevolence in Dr. Montague that I didn't see there. The uncaringness.
He's mean, yeah. How do I explain, you know, I'd have to think that his wife is not as bad as that. And it's interesting that you brought that up because I was just thinking, you know, why on earth is this guy with her and why does he stay? That was a problem for me, too. But the fact that maybe she wasn't as described, that's really interesting.
Well, or... Of course, the feeling you get when you're just reading it, and that I've had for quite a long time, is just that he's henpecked.
Yeah, and if he's henpecked or whatever, you know, his motivations for doing things, you know, trying to impress people and stuff kind of enforces my view of him, which means that he's willing to do horrible things in order to get noticed by the science community or whatever.
Yeah. Although I don't think she was like really great and we just didn't see it. It's just that we get those glimpses of her that are different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because she was a kind of a nut. I feel like there was a nun here. And maybe also, you know, Planchette was very insistent.
And that was funny because, you know, they said, you know, nuns are, didn't the professor say that shows up a lot or something like that?
Yeah.
There's always nuns.
Yeah, of course. She goes, are you trying to say Planchette was lying to me because Planchet would never lie. And then after the, I can't remember what it was, but at some point she's very angry with him. She's like, what did you do, Arthur? Or not Arthur, but to her husband, whatever his name is. Planchet won't even speak to me. And, you know, Arthur goes around very earnestly. Well, it's kind of touchy, you know. It's really wonderful because it provides kind of a comic relief.
Yeah.
Which is what Luke and Theo provide at the beginning, because you have to have that, because if it's unrelenting gloom and scariness through the book, eventually it doesn't have any effect anymore.
Right.
And I guess that's kind of the effect in The Shining that Danny has, the little boy, because he's a little boy.
Yeah.
So he kind of lightens things up until horrible things start to happen to him.
Right.
Because of The Shining. One of the best Simpsons episodes ever, I'm just going to say. Actually, it was a Treehouse of Horror, which are almost all the best episodes of The Simpsons ever.
I need
ever.
To watch those. I haven't seen them.
What?
I know. Oh. I've watched so little Simpsons. I don't know what's wrong with me. I've seen some, but
oh my
not
gosh.
Very many.
Oh my gosh, the layers that are being peeled off in this book, I mean, through talking about this book, I just now finally find this out. What else are you hiding from me, Scott?
Oh, that's funny.
Are you really American? I just want.
Actually, no, I am not American.
Mexico, I see. Which, speaking of people from Mexico, I just want to say, I love Guillermo del Toro, okay? I've kind of got a crush on him, but I finally, after listening to his commentary, or at least half of it, which you were so kind as to send me, I had this picture of him in my head, and then I saw his actual picture. I was like...
He looks like a Simpsons character, doesn't he?
I don't want to be too superficial. He could be a Simpsons character, or he could possibly be a dwarf in The Lord of the Rings. I'm just like, I don't know how tall he is, but I'm just saying. I was like, oh, I have to love the inner man. Got it. Okay.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which I guess people
were
might
you expecting
see
Matthew McConaughey or something?
If only he'd have had his shirt off. No, wait. I'm glad he didn't. Well, and that's cruel, because people might see me and say, oh, your voice sounds so nice.
Oh, that's funny. That's
but anyway.
Funny. Matthew McConaughey could play Luke in this book.
Oh, yes. Mm. He's just superficial enough and shallow enough. I think it might suit him,
you bet.
She said unfairly. I know he's been going for the juicier roles lately.
You bet.
He's coming up in some movie that's just coming out about an AIDS victim.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's lost 40 pounds for it. And I'm thinking, well, he must be skeletal then at that point. But I saw something somewhere. I can't remember the name of it. But of course, all the people love it and all the awards ceremony, you know, all the things it's entered for, because, you know, why wouldn't they? But and it's probably wonderful. Mm-hmm. But he's a real life character who got AIDS. Who knows how, but he was like a hillbilly homophobe kind of thing. So, you know, one of those little ironies.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I think the point of the story is that he then turns all his efforts into trying to find a cure. And so he's investing in all these crazy drugs and things and selling them to people and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So
very interesting. Yeah. Well, I've brought us something extra today, which I am halfway finished with, and talk about narration. I'm listening to The Halloween Tree by Ray Bradbury, because you got to have Bradbury during October.
Yes, you do.
And it is read by Bronson Pinchot, and it is stunning so far.
Oh.
I mean, it's only like 3 hours long, unabridged. So
right.
Got it from downpour.com.
Okay.
And... it's just fantastic. Really great.
Well, and I was actually looking at The Halloween Tree earlier this month, and then I forgot it, so I'm glad you brought it up again, because I was thinking that audio might be good, but my Audible credit doesn't come up until the, 26th. I guess it's up now.
Gotcha.
Although,
ooh,
yeah, maybe I should get that.
Yeah. It was like $6.95 on Downpour.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it still is, but that's, I mean, it was cheap.
Isn't that funny how Bronson Pinchot has gotten really into audiobook narration? Didn't he play on some show, some weird foreign person?
Yeah, he was.
Who was humorous?
Yeah, he played a couple of them. It was called. I was going to say Bosom Buddies, but that's Tom Hanks.
Nope. yes.
I know what you're talking about, though. He was, yeah.
I can't remember
the name of the sitcom, but it was a sitcom. And then he was the strange guy in Beverly Hills Cop, too. Kind of the same type.
Oh, okay. Well, he was he was some foreign cousin or something.
Yeah, Balky, yeah.
That's it.
But he is such an incredible audiobook narrator. I haven't listened to anything that he's done that I haven't thought was really great.
I've heard he's good. I just have never listened to a book he happened to narrate. Maybe this will be my first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I'll get hooked like I am with Simon Vance.
He's that good, I think.
Yeah. Simon Vance good?
Yeah, I would say yes.
Scott Rick good? Come on.
I would say yes, yeah.
Did you listen
in the tops.
To SFF Audio's interview with Simon Vance?
It
was Luke and Jesse talking to him. And I listened to his reading of an H.G. Wells story and went, mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, I forgot how good you are. And then I went ahead and they have a separate episode that's just talking to him. And I'm, of course, always interested to listen to narrators because then it reminds me of how high my star is that I have to grab for. And yeah. So far above me. And mm-hmm. It was just interesting hearing him talk about the craft and how he got into it and, you know, how on Audible now, because Audible is doing all these narrations that they're sponsoring and paying for. And he's like, well, a lot of them are fine. Just like, that's so polite. He's like, they aren't really very artful, but they're okay. And I'm like, okay. So, wow. But he was saying, and that's why did I get onto this? He was saying that somebody, and I can't remember who, describes Scott Brick as the Brad Pitt of narrators. And they describe Simon Vance as the George Clooney of narrators.
Nice.
And I'm like, oh, I don't really think as much of George Clooney as some people do. Hopefully that person who was describing him did. I like George Clooney pretty well, but,
yeah.
You know.
Yep, gotcha. Yeah, my favorite narrator passed away a while ago. Frank Muller is somebody I could never get enough of. I really like him.
Okay, I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, he's got a lot out there, but he passed away from a motorcycle accident.
Oh.
Years ago, you know, probably 5 or 6 years ago.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Beach Music is probably my favorite of his narrations by Pat Conroy.
Is that book that you asked if I'd be willing to read one time?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. Yeah,
okay.
It's still thinking about it. It's a bit long, but Pat Conroy is he has really nice moments, you know, in his mm-hmm. writing that are really, you know, kind of amazing.
I've never read anything by him. I always think of him more of a, I don't know, I don't want to say Danielle Steele type, but I don't know.
I don't know. I wouldn't say that, although I've never read Danielle Steele.
Oh, soap opera-ish kind of.
Well,
but
possibly.
But I thought it was a completely false impression.
Yeah, he wrote, oh, shoot, I'm trying to remember some titles. I'm gonna have to call up some titles, but he has a lot of father issues. Had a bad dad, you know. So some of the stuff that he wrote is some pretty stunning father stuff.
Gotcha.
Let's see. I mean, he's got, there it is, The Prince of Tides. The Great Santini is that's an example of that was like his dad.
I tried to watch that movie once. I didn't get very far.
Yeah, yeah.
But the movie isn't the book.
Right, right.
And, you know, I actually might truly love him. I'm just never going to pick him on my own.
Mm-hmm, sure. And I haven't read a lot of his stuff. I've read Beach Music, which I really, really liked. And then he wrote a nonfiction one called My Losing Season, which I really liked.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that. Maybe from you.
Maybe so.
I don't know.
Yep.
Well, Shirley Jackson is one of my, I guess you'd call her oddball, not very well-known mm-hmm. favorites. Not like Pat Conroy at all, it sounds like. But Yeah. So I appreciate you. I'm glad you hadn't read it before and that you liked it.
No, I mean, it's one of those things that I just love that I read it. You know, I'm really happy to have read it.
Oh,
it's it was a hole in my canon or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, especially for horror fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I like. You know, I've read a lot of Stephen King, and it's Stephen King is definitely influenced by her. It's almost like he's took her and then started there. You know, he says, well, this is what I want to write. You know, I want to be like her. And then he did.
And it's interesting because his name has popped up recently. Oh, right. Because I'm going to put out, hopefully today, Young Goodman Brown by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was looking on, you know, my favorite sort resource, Wikipedia. And it was saying that he specifically cites that story as influencing one of his other stories.
Yeah.
And he puts that story in one of the top 10 stories, the Young Goodman Brown, Stephen King. And I was like,
Young Goodman Brown, that's a good story. That is a good story.
Yeah. It is. Oh, my gosh. Talk about ambiguous.
Heck yeah. Yeah. Look forward to hearing it.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I hope it's enjoyable. I also have Rappaccini's Daughter in two parts.
That's cool. Yeah.
That I put
Now, I attempted to read The Judge's House by Bram Stoker, which is the first time I heard of that was in an introduction to Salem's Lot by Stephen King, written by Stephen King, the introduction. And what's interesting is that came before this one, and I wonder if she was influenced by The Judge's House a little bit. Because the Judge's house, again, it was a house that was there that everybody in the town knew there was something wrong with it, and you don't want to live there. And this guy comes to rent it because he wants some quiet place to do studying.
Like, oh, it's a little too quiet. Well, yes, that house was influenced by the evil judge who lived and, I believe, died there. I can't remember. Right. I love that story.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be Halloween if you wind up reading it.
I will do it. I will do it again. But, yeah, it was horrid. I read much too quickly. And I think, well, that was really the main thing.
Was it?
When I was finished with it, I had read it much too quickly. It was like, I need to slow that way down.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have heard other podcasters say, and I tried to follow this when I started reading stuff, and I think sometimes I speed up too much myself, but is always read it a little slower than you think you should.
Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing when you're on stage.
Like, is it?
If you're going to do lines, it's natural for someone, once they get out in front of an audience, to just go really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's why you got to have dress rehearsals and things where they have people in front of them so you can see that in them if it's there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, once they get nervous, it's like, brah! And you're like, holy cow, I didn't understand a word of what you said.
I know. Well,
now we don't know who did it.
It's the worst when it's a mystery.
Yeah,
we missed half
the
clues.
Yep.
Well, and that's what we tell people when they're practicing their Beyond Cana talks for the marriage retreat, because it's a couple going back and forth, usually doing a talk.
Yeah.
And we say, yeah, you already know what you're saying, so you're trying to make a good impression, but these people haven't heard this before.
Yeah.
Unlike you, who've heard it about 50 times. So, yes, you have to go slowly so they can hear it, absorb it, and keep going.
Right, right.
So
that's what I must do with The Judge's House. But it is a neat story.
Pretend you're acting it.
An actor.
You read a sample of something that you were going to read for Jesse.
Yeah, yeah.
And I almost felt like you were sitting on a stage in the middle. It was like a John Houseman moment or something.
Wow.
Sitting on the stage on a stool and you're reading it to us. It was wonderful.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yes, it was really great.
Yay. Well,
everybody, send Scott emails so he'll read the story.
I will do it. I will do it.
Okay.
My fans demand.
I think the house got in your head a little.
That's right. I think so. I love it.
Well, speaking of fans, we did have an exciting thing happen. Was it last week when I was looking through the philosophy section of podcasts at Goodreads or for iTunes? And I was just scrolling through what's hot, and I was like, what? I recognize that. That's how did a good story's hard to find, get in there.
Oh, that's cool. I
love it. Was
that.
Just for a day, but it was pretty exciting.
That's cool. Yeah, people go there and put some stars on there for us.
Yeah, give us some reviews. We don't ever ask for that, but if you do like listening, just give a review or put a star. Put 5 stars. You could put 4. But really, put something there, because that's what helps other people find us.
Heck yeah, you bet.
So that's my October pledge drive plea. Yes, I do. At Forgotten Classics, I do October pledge drive for podcasts, which is when I say give people a few bucks if they want it for bandwidth, or give them a review at iTunes. Now, no one has done that for me this time at Forgotten Classics. I'm sad, but I guess that's okay. I could take it. Give it to good
stories.
Yeah, give it to good story.
There you go. Yep. Well, cool. Okay. So what do we have coming up here?
Ooh, Lincoln?
Yeah, Lincoln. We're going to talk about Lincoln, the movie by Steven Spielberg, on November the 14th. And then on November 28th, something which I cannot wait to read, Unholy Night, by Seth Graham Smith, the person who brought us Abraham Lincoln,
Vampire Hunter,
right?
Which is not the movie we're going to discuss next time, by the way. Scott went in a very sad, unhorrorish direction. That's so right. What are you going to do?
But it's November.
Yeah, true. A little bit more stately. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln, I believe, signed Thanksgiving into law.
Ooh.
So that's
your... I didn't know that. See, I had no ideas. That's exactly what I was thinking when I picked
it. You know, you're many levels again. This is great.
It's magical.
Yes. And then do we want to talk about the upcoming months after that?
I guess we can. Yeah. What's going on is I'm going to be traveling for work. So we're So it's going to be very difficult to record this podcast. So we won't have any shows in December, but we'll be back in January. And it'll be one a month for a couple of months there, and then hopefully we'll be right back on track.
Yeah.
So
Which so I feel like you're doing pretty well to even think of one a month with all the traveling you're going to do.
I cannot wait. Yeah, I mean, how do I not do this? It's
this is fun.
Yeah, it's a highlight.
I feel the same way too. I just enjoy it so much.
Yeah, I really do. I really do. I mean, here I was in October, and there wasn't enough October in my October, and I get to read The Haunting of Hill House and Pan's Labyrinth. Right?
Well,
which leads me to Ray Bradbury, which if you have an October without Ray Bradbury, you've missed it.
That's right.
So, this just keeps me on track.
The Halloween Tree, and everybody, if you haven't listened to it, we have Something Wicked This Way Comes in the library. So go to the library or to the book section.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And get that.
Mm-hmm.
We have plenty of other horror fiction, but that's for a different time of year.
Heck yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, October horror is different, you know?
Agreed.
I mean, we do zombies and stuff, but that's not really October.
No.
Yeah.
That's really,
ordinary horror, right.
Yes.
But this, The Haunting of Hill House, is excellent. And Pan's Labyrinth was excellent.
Good. And World War Z.
Yeah.
It's not horror, but it did have zombies, so it was a great kickoff.
Right.
So well done. Yes. Yes.
That was a good episode.
Although I did, on a last note, I did see Gravity.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
And you know the thing I said about World War Z, the movie, where I said, you know, I was watching Brad Pitt, and I knew there'd be jump scenes, but I always felt like, this is Brad Pitt. He's going to get out alive. So I had a certain lack of suspense about that.
Yeah.
I never felt that about Gravity, ever.
Okay.
I didn't stop to think it. There were times when I was just spending all my time leaning sideways in my seat going, grab this thing, grab it, hold on, etc.
That's cool.
It was really great. As one critic I saw called it, a two-person survival/adventure movie.
Nice.
And it's only 90 minutes long.
That's cool. Now, is it correct that you have not seen any of the Harry Potter films?
I saw 1 through 3.
Okay. I was going to say
Yeah,
if you
three was the
decide to
best.
see one, number three is the one to see. It's by the same director as Gravity,
Yes.
Alfonso Cuarón.
Yes.
But
That was
I
the one
love
that
that
came
movie.
alive.
That's the only one that I'd really want to keep.
Okay.
Yeah, I just love the whole look and feel of that movie.
And it was a breath of fresh air because I know the first one was directed by Chris Columbus and maybe the second one
I think the
also.
second one was too, yeah.
And they were so perfectly adapted, or they were so perfectly a copy of the book that they were very stiff seeming. And that third one, I didn't stop to worry about if it was a perfect copy of the book because it just came alive. Like you said, it
I
was.
don't know what it is with Chris Columbus, but his movies, there's some kind of a chaotic something about his movies, like it's like having a whole bunch of people in a room talking at once. It's kind of a feel that I get with most of his movies, and both of the first two Harry Potters were that way for me too. It's like, didn't he do Goonies? I'm
Oh, I
trying to
never
remember
saw
everything that
that.
he's done, but
I was trying to think because I don't think I've seen any other movies by
it's
him.
almost, there's moments in his movies that I just want to turn the sound off.
Ah, that's
Yeah.
interesting.
But I felt the same way about the first two Harry Potter movies. I didn't hate them or anything like that. They were fine. But number three I thought was really great. It really captured the characters, and the look of it was cool. Really great.
Yeah, I can't define what was different, but it was definitely different. It didn't make me want to see any of the other movies. At those points, I was going because my kids were going and we'd been reading the books out loud from the time they came out. So, but that was the last time they were old enough that they could then start going with groups of friends, dressing up at midnight and going off with their friends or whatever they would
Yeah.
do at
Well,
those
from that
groups.
point on, four through seven, the books are clearly better. I mean, the book's always better, right? But the books are like 800 pages long, and you're putting it in a 2-hour movie, so you know what you're doing there. You're missing a heck of a lot.
Yeah, exactly. You can't really
Hard
convey
to make
everything.
a good coherent movie.
And I think that's why Rose was saying that she would always go with all her friends because they were always up for the whole experience and they'd dress up and they'd go to the midnight showings and but she just went for the experience of being with her friends and doing it because she's like the movies never of this series were never as good as the book. It didn't matter how good the movies were. So she didn't really ever care about them. So
I understand that. No question.
there you go. Yeah, so all right, everybody, you have to get Unholy Night.
Unholy Night. Yes, by Seth Graham Smith.
Yes, and the reading is sensational. I
Oh,
can't
good.
remember who it's by. I don't have it in front of me, but I. Oh, the library had it. That's why.
Cool.
I don't
Okay.
even know why I got. Oh, wait, I do know why I got it. Sorry. I'm just spending all my time reversing myself because I was so annoyed by the whole concept that I was going to read it so I could denounce it. Very similar to the book that started us off, The Reapers of the Angels.
Oh,
And
cool.
instead, very much like that, I wound up embracing it.
Oh, neat.
It
Okay.
is no Reapers of the Angels, but it's very good.
All right, cool. Looking forward
So,
to it.
yep.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, well, thanks for listening, everybody. Happy Halloween.
Yes. Go trick-or-treating tonight. Talk to you in a couple
All right,
weeks.
see you later.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye.